Man like Mark Sullivan, worry yourself. Stay tuned for the chilling episode. Woo!
Quite a lot of them are uncooperative.
They'll just lip us off.
Tell you to get lost, mind your own business.
They're dangerous. And most of them have no brakes on them.
When you get skiers and snowboarders together on a run, you're looking for trouble.
We just like to say that we don't want them at all.
This is the Snowboard Project, Season 2, end of story.
I'm stoked. You stoked?
I'm stoked.
Just
I'm stoked.
So stoked.
Today I'm joined by Jeremy Jensen, and he is the founder of Grassroots Pow Surf. Is that correct? Am I saying that right? Grassroots Pow Surf?
Yep.
Cool. So, you know, starting out, I guess first of all, let's define the difference between snowboarding, powder surfing, no boarding, snow skating, and maybe even powder skating if you want to get crazy. What are the differences?
I guess it just boils down to the equipment and the technique or whatever, but you know, snowboarding, you're obviously strapped into a snowboard that's designed to have, you know, bindings on it, and they're set up in a certain way that, you know, allows you to work the board it was designed, the way it was designed to work. Snow skate is, there's a bunch of forms of snow skates, I guess, the flat deck style that came out back in the day from Hood, like Andy Wolf and Premier and all that was probably back in the 90s, I guess. And then bi-deck snow skating, you know, basically a skateboard deck with a ski on the bottom.
Yep.
And kind of a set of trucks that allows that ski to flex. So, you know, those are in the bindingless realm. I guess snow skates and pow surfs are in the, you know, the bindingless realm. There's no binding. There's no, you know, you're not holding on any rope or any bungee cords or, you know, whereas like the no board was kind of a hybrid between, I don't know, snurfing and snowboarding, I guess. They basically took a snowboard that was designed to have bindings on it, and they attached a bungee to the, you know, in front of the foot, back of the foot. And so you hold the board to your foot, so you use the bungee cord in your hand to hold it to your feet to basically do what bindings were doing. You know, your feet are in that same spot to where you can really take advantage of the flex and the cut of the board, but you know, you're kind of holding it to your feet, whereas and a pow surfer is just basically like a surfboard for the snow, so right. or a skateboard for the snow. It's almost like a giant snow skate, flat deck snow skate in some ways, you know, but it's probably more closer to a surfboard, but you know, it's designed to be stood on in a certain way, and you're completely hands-free, binding-free. You can do, you know, skate-style tricks because you're not attached to it. It rides a lot like a surfboard because you're kind of more towards the back. You're turning off of the tail a lot of the time. And, you know, of course, you can bring in skate-style. You can do shove-its and kick-flips and 360 flips. And I don't know, it's just a true binding-free way to surf the snow.
Yeah.
Quite literally.
So you're like one of the guys who's like the innovator. I mean, you own PowSurf.com, first of all, which is like, that's the name of the discipline of sport, I guess. Say, how did you come into taking the bindings off? I mean, how did that start? What was the genesis of that for you?
Well, I mean, if you go way back, we did it back when I couldn't afford a snowboard. Mm-hmm. Took your skateboard, trucks and wheels off, flipped it backwards, and you've tried to make it down the hill, more or less, when I was, you know, before I ever had a snowboard or could afford a snowboard. We did that, but you know, after years of snowboarding, I guess we did the first bindingless thing was kind of like the bi-deck snow skates.
Mm-hmm.
And just standing on, you know, your snowboard, like we'd go hit kickers in the backcountry and we'd just kind of stand on our snowboards between the front and back binding and just, you know, ride the mellow. If we're out hiking, you know, mellow stuff, you can ride across the flats like that, you know, without having to strap in, strap out, you know. So we just started kind of riding like our snowboards like that, screwing around. And then you know, bi-deck snow skates were out, and so that was real fun because it was finally a board that you could actually turn you know, the single deck ones were kind of made to just go straight and hit rails and jumps and things. And the bi-deck brought turning into it. And then, and we just, I guess in the 90s, we were doing, you know, I had an old Sims blade that the tail had broke off. And so I'd mess around with like reshaping that and putting just stomp pads and a old boot lace on that as a leash. And so we would, I'd ride that quite a bit in the early season when, you know, it's just, there's not enough snow to make, to fill in the good lines and the big lines to do jumps and cliffs and shoots and the stuff I like to do on my snowboard. So it just kind of made, you know, playing like that just made that stuff a little more interesting. It didn't work super good, but you know, it was kind of, it was good for some shits and giggles. And so that, I guess it was in the 90s when I first started, you know, pow surfing. That word didn't exist back then, of course, but, and then in 07, we started, just pressing our own and that way we can control, profile shape with, you know, especially we're trying to cut apart these snowboards that were already just too narrow anyways to really make decent pow surfers, and the flex was not proper on them, and the cut where you'd need to stand on the board, the side cuts were off, because you kind of had to stand way back on them to make them actually turn in pow. Mm-hmm. So yeah, we just kind of started cutting them out in, you know, back in 06 07, and screwing around then, and back then we didn't really know what to call it, but, you know, every time we'd go out riding, it was like, oh, we're surfing the pow, basically. Mm-hmm. Let's go surf the pow. I'd call up my buddy and be like, you know, let's go surf pow. And so eventually we thought, you know, pow surf or powder surf would be the best thing to call it, because it kind of made sense, kind of like skateboard or skateboarding, you know.
Yeah.
Skateboard probably used to be two words also. And then, so we kind of made up, you know, a one-word way to define that that people could understand. I didn't know if people would understand, you know, pow surf, if they understood the slang of pow, like most snowboarders obviously do. But just thinking on a bigger scale, I was like, okay, well, let's call it powder surfing and pow surfing for short, and whatever takes works. And so that's, I mean, back in the day, we called them Vimana.
Vimana.
Which is like a Vimana, yes. It's like an ancient flying machine.
Okay.
It's a word that comes from, I believe it's in Egyptian writings. It's in a whole bunch of ancient writings, and it comes up, and it's basically a flying machine some refer to it as like a flying carpet, basically, that you could stand on and it would magically fly you away. And a lot of the time these things were very alien, you know, in these writings, like they came from another planet. And so we thought that was a pretty cool thing to call it or whatever. But I didn't think that would stick.
Right.
You know, it's just a word that many people would understand. And so we figured we should call it something that people could, that was more understandable and people could kind of grasp just by the word alone, like powder surfing.
Yeah.
Powder, right?
When I grew up on the East Coast, there were people who called it Burton boarding, and it's like that never stuck. But snowboarding actually kind of made sense. You know, it was like intuitive that you would actually like know what it means just by saying it, you know? And
yeah, and that was my goal. You know, I scoured the web for months and months trying to find, you know, is there anything that's like this? You know, obviously there's like snurfing, which is, you know, kind of a silly word, and it didn't really, and it was similar to what we were doing, you know. I mean, back then they were kind of riding on a water ski, but they were, you know, turning it on the rope.
Yep.
In the back seat, you know, and this was, you know, it was a lot more like surfing, so I really wanted to incorporate that word into it. Just to make it easier to understand and more relatable, and make it its own thing too, because there hadn't really been devices like this out there, you know, save for some of the earliest snowboard contraptions, like, you know, Dimitri's first prototype. You know, he says he rode that without, you know, any sort of the bungee or any of the rubber or any of the nylon back then on that. He, you know, the first runs he took up at Snowbird were just like a boot lace tied to it. You know, I've come to find out later, I didn't know this at the time. I didn't know anything about snowboarding history at the time. In fact, I'd never even seen a snurfer back then. But we did have, after some of those first cut up experimental boards, we got on a Winterstick Roundtail Plus from, I think it was 85, it was, I believe. Mm-hmm. And it had like the nubbies on it, right? The grip.
Yep.
And like that thing worked way better than any other snowboard we tried, or any cut-up snowboard, or any
did it work,
you know,
better than
a regular snowboard.
Did it work better than like the boards you were making like at that time?
No, and that was before we started cutting those. That was one of those old style boards that we played around with to try to figure this out, and I mean it didn't, but I was able to take, you know, it didn't work as well as the ones we started making initially, but I was able to take a lot, you know, from that winter stick as far as certain widths on the boards and contours and especially, you know, widths driving from the back. Those old round tails are extremely skinny in the back, which actually it caused a lot of foot drag, but it gave you leverage. And, you know, so I learned a lot from that. And that was kind of what like really lit a flame. 'Cause I was like, we rode that one day and we're like, okay, this is like possible. This is, you know, we should start to make something that we think will work and shape it in the way that we think can work a lot better than this. And sure enough it did, but you know, that winter stick round tail plus was a huge, turned on the light bulb really and got the gears going.
Cool.
Just allowing us to know that we could actually find a way to surf on snow, you know, without bindings and ropes and all that stuff that they had back in the, you know, the 60s and 70s with the snurfer and stuff.
So, you know, when I first saw pictures or video of you, powder surfing, you know, my impression was, at least, and that's why I'm asking you, is that like you would use it almost like a like one of those premier snow skates. Obviously, you could turn it though, but then you'd find an obstacle and do a shove it or do a kick flip or something like that, like skate style tricks in the powder. Was it like that, or was it really about the experience of actually like riding the white winter wave?
Well, it was both, but we just didn't think the turning part was as exciting to watch.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, and a lot of those, you know, the first couple of years we were doing this, we were just screwing around, you know, like we were going snowboarding and then we would just kind of bring these things with us and we'd end up at the bottom of slopes, you know? And so riding fallen trees and picnic tables and, you know, just random things that are in our kind of early season zone that we go ride.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it was so easy to just make a quick little bump to do a kickflip off of, or, you know, get a little natural hip going, or, you know, slide a rail that some kids had brought up to, you know, snowboard and do board slides on. And so all that stuff was just sitting there and at the bottom of the hills. And so it's a lot easier to film, you know, but it's like street style snowboarding. It's a lot easier to film it, you know, so you walk up to the spot, you start doing it instead of like hiking your gear way up the side of the mountain and shooting some pow turns. I mean, we definitely did a lot of pow turns and top to bottoms and such, but it was so easy to get that, you know, the more smaller scale and the skate stuff, which was exciting to us too, because that was the type of stuff that had never been done in powder snow.
Right.
You know, no one had ever done like a kickflip on into pow, you know, or like a three flip or even a backside 180 without bindings, you know, like all that stuff. Was really exciting to me because I was, you know, I grew up skateboarding and I was, and obsessed with surfing, of course, but my access to the ocean is super limited here in Utah, obviously, and growing up really without money and pretty poor as a kid, like just didn't have that luxury. So a lot of my background came from skateboarding, and that's the kind of stuff that we were, you know, you could take some video of us ripping down the hill, but it just looked like we were snowboarding almost. And so that, in my mind, it would be as catchy and noticeable for people. They'd be like, oh, it's just some guy riding like a mellow, you know, mellow mountain on a snowboard. And you could hardly tell the difference. And that's even the case now when, you know, we're doing these big lines. It's like, unless I put like a bomb drop at the beginning of the clip or, you know, keep the film rolling where he jumps off at the end, like you hardly even knew he was without bindings. And so, you know, the skate stuff was like really exciting because obviously it was no bindings. You know, the guy just did a kickflip. He just did a three flip. Like obviously the board wasn't attached to his feet. What the hell is going on here? You know, it was so, no one had seen that stuff.
Right.
And no one had seen pow surfing even at all back, you know, back in those early 2000s either. So a lot of that, the earliest video we put out was like kind of that stuff. So it could actually catch eyes and people would be stoked on it. And for all those first, oh God, the first 6 years, all the footage we were putting out was, you know, it was 2, 3, 4 years old, kind of on purpose. 'Cause we were like, you know, this is probably going to take off and you know, we'll put out this old footage, and then if people do start like putting out some stuff, we'll start to compete with it or whatever, you know, we'll put out, you know, fresher footage that shows where we're really at, you know, because we were, you know, progression wise, we were way ahead of all that, but we were just kind of leaking it out slowly, to the public just to kind of get them hooked on it. And then, you know, we'll show in those early days, you'd get, there was no social media, there was no Facebook, there was none of that had really come around yet. And so it was, you know, showing up on blogs and things like that. And so you'd see people's comments, and they're like, oh yeah, that'd be really fun on a 20 degree slope with like knee deep powder. And, you know, we're just kind of giggling like, yeah, it obviously doesn't need to be knee deep. We can ride in like 3 or 4 inches, and we can ride, you know, a 40 plus degree slope, no problem.
Yeah, but you know, you were like in tune
at that point.
You were in tune though to marketing and like having like video edits and stuff like that, and doing the marketing kind of the sport as well as making the product. And so was that from snowboarding and skateboarding that you kind of had that like marketing awareness? Because I would say, you know, early snowboarding, it happened in a bubble to a large degree, the development of that, where it wasn't really being marketed to the skiers at that time or skateboarders at that time, maybe as much as, you know, as like when you came out with your product, you were also doing marketing along with it to help build awareness or let people know what you were doing.
Yeah. I mean, I was trying. I didn't know shit about marketing. But I did know, you know, I grew up shooting skate videos and snowboard videos, and, you know, I'd made a couple snowboard videos. And so, you know, that came natural. That's one of my passions, is to create video and photo. And so, you know, that was kind of a natural thing for me. But, you know, figuring out marketing and figuring out business was really a pain in the ass. Like, I really had no interest in it.
Mm-hmm. What about especially manufacturing? Business.
Like, I didn't.
What about the manufacturing?
I don't know. I didn't want to do any of that.
What did you want to do? Because they were so hard to make. Yeah,
they were so time consuming and difficult to make. Because back then, you know, everything was by hand. I had pure hand tools. You know, I'm making, you know, carving in these three-dimensional bases with just sandpaper and a hand sander. You know, like I didn't have anything to work with. I'm, you know, I was this spread out of the, you know, the little garage inside of my house that was like 8x8, and so I didn't have anything. I didn't really have any knowledge of like woodworking or anything like that. So it took us so long, and, you know, I'm talking to a couple friends like, should we start putting out videos? Should we do this? And we're like, well, how are we going to get the boards made? Like, they're such a bitch to make. Like, we're going to have to charge so much money to make them. So that was a hurdle for sure. Cause, you know, I work, everybody already has a full-time job, you know, it's a lot of work to make a single board. And so figuring that out took a long time, to how to streamline a process and, you know, get the boards looking professional, more professional. And then, you know, I taught myself to edit video and shoot video for years. And so I taught myself web design and just tried to figure out. Back then it was like the early stages of, you know, blogs, and then Facebook started to come out. So that was like super helpful for me, because I could put up a video and on Facebook or whatever. Back in the day, that was when like things you put up actually showed up on people's like feeds, mm-hmm. without paying them money or whatever. And so these videos would go all over the world, you know? And so instantly it was like, I had a world, you know, the whole world as an audience, even being so small, just out of this little garage in Utah. So I really had to just make myself figure out, you know, business, like, what the hell do I do? I get a business license. Like, what, like, all that was a real pain in the ass for me. And I didn't really want to do it, because I've never really been a fan of business. Mm-hmm. So that was just something I felt. I was like, well, this is our little thing. We need to run with it. Like, I don't want to, you know, someone else will just pick this up and steal it from me and do it. And so if I don't do it, you know, and teach myself to do all this stuff, then it just won't happen for me. It'll just get snaked by somebody else, you know? And so I kind of had to force myself to learn all those things about business and about marketing and do it in a hurry, you know, to get it off the ground. Cause we'd already been doing it for a little while, and we had this video footage, and it's that we'd been sitting on, that we thought, you know, people are going to trip out on this. So I just had to put my head down and do it, you know, all while working a regular 9 to 5. And so it was tough. And a shitload of work for one guy to do. Like, I had no money. I couldn't afford, you know, to pay somebody to do any of this other stuff. So I was literally having to do every aspect of it myself, from production to marketing to, you know, every little bit of it.
Yeah. So, speaking to that, being an entrepreneur and like a full circle entrepreneur, there's so many different aspects of it. You had a product to make, you had to market this product, then you had to sell the product, and then do customer service and collections, or just deal with all the different aspects of business. What was the hardest part of like starting a business and actually starting something that like people didn't understand? And like, what was the hardest part of that?
That was the hardest part, is that people didn't understand it. Really, like, I mean, the other shit is just like you're selling a product like any other business does, and once you learn how that works, you can do it. But like selling a product that no one's ever held in their hands or seen or set foot on or can really even understand, like I say, those early blogs, people's, when you first got to see, you know, people's reactions from around the world, you know, they just didn't get it. They would be like, oh, that's cool, but that's like riding a fixed gear bike or something. And it's like, you know, they make all these, jump to these quick assumptions of what it is and what's possible on it and what you'll ever be able to do on it. And, you know, people are just like, oh, I'll never be able to do that. I don't live in the Canadian Rockies where it snows 3 feet every day, you know, because it's obviously got to be waist deep powder and knee deep powder. And we're just, you know, kind of rolling our eyes like, shit, okay, now we have to make another video that makes it obvious that you can ride this in 3 or 4 inches. And so it's like, I don't know. It takes a long time to put out that content. It takes a long time to get people to see it. And, you know, you can get on a chat room and talk all you want, but until people see it in action, that's what was really going to help. And that's why the video element was so important, to show people what was really possible and to help them at least see it enough to where they would maybe be like, okay, yeah, that looks really fun. And then once you get a person on it, it's the easiest sell in the world. Then they get it, you know. No one's ever going to get it until they actually ride one and feel how amazing it is just to make a simple turn, you know, or link 3 or 4 turns together. It's like, you know, they're smiling like little kids, you know. It totally brings back all those memories of being a kid and, you know, learning to snowboard, learning to skateboard, learning to surf, you know. Like, you feel like progression moves faster because you have the basic skills from either skateboarding, snowboarding, or surfing. And from the beginning, I knew that was going to be my audience, you know, snowboarders, backcountry snowboarders, snowboarders who skate, you know, possibly skateboarders, but most skateboarders who don't actually snowboard just don't live in a place for it, or they don't, you know, they don't think to go there, or maybe they look down on snowboarding because, you know, they're riding with the thing attached to their feet or, you know, whatever. But, but those were the small little niches in little markets that I thought maybe I could pitch to.
So what are the prerequisites? Like, you have to have some kind of skill, either with skateboarding, snowboarding, or surfing. Maybe snowboarding's the best one. What are the prerequisites before you actually take the bindings off, let's say? Or, like, what do you have to know how to do? Do you have to have backcountry knowledge? Do you have to be a pro snowboarder? I mean, what do you have to do before you start?
You don't have to do anything, man. It's, like, it's so easy to do. Like, I take my... like my daughter, since she was 2 years old, you know, like she could stand on the thing and cruise and giggle like mad, you know. Mm-hmm. It's like, you remember when you tried to slide on the sled hill and stand up on your sled, you know. Mm-hmm. Like it doesn't take that much skill, and you can do it in so many places. Like, you don't have to go into avalanche terrain. You don't have to have these insane skate skills. You don't have to do a kickflip or a shove it. You can make turns, and it's, you know, shits and giggles. It's super fun. It feels amazing. And so, you know, it does help to have a little bit of background, but I've taken a whole grip of people out that have had zero experience ever, even snowboarding or skiing or being on snow in general, and had them pick it up within, you know, a few laps or a few runs, you know, linking turns, and super stoked the look on their face, you know. So it really doesn't take that much, you know. Obviously all that, you know, skateboarding helps with your balance. Snowboarding helps because you're used to sliding on an element. You're used to dealing with snow. You can kind of pick out what's good snow and what isn't. Having like backcountry experience helps a lot, because you can be like, well, it was windy last night, so maybe the mid elevation north facing slopes are going to be really good today, and still dry and still cold, and so there's going to be deeper powder there, you know. Just knowing, I mean, like surfing, it's like, it's knowing the element definitely helps, and knowing you know, where the waves are going to be definitely helps. But, you know, so many places around the world, it snows, you know, just enough in town where you could take it to the sledding hill and have a blast, or, you know, the backyard of the foothills, or, you know, there's so many areas. And until you start doing it, maybe it's difficult to realize that or see those areas. But as soon as you've foul surfed a couple of times, like, you view the terrain completely differently. So you'll be on your way up to your ski resort or whatever and look at the side of the road and be like, oh shit, I've never really looked at that closely. That would be an awesome foul surf spot. Or, you know, maybe some of the spots that are just too short of a distance but have cool features in them that you wouldn't really bother walking all the way up to strap into your snowboard. You could set a boot pack or a vert pack up that and easily session that for a couple hours and have a blast, you know? So once you start doing it, your eyes, you know, you become more in tune to what is a good area to do it. But like I say, it doesn't really take much on a micro level. If you want to experience it, you could do it at a sledding hill or the backyard or the golf course, you know, basically all the places where I learned to snowboard. Those places are really
good. But you want untracked snow. You don't want to do it like somewhere where there's a ton of tracks or ice or stuff like that. Like conditions.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. You want soft snow. I mean, it's like surfing. You can't just walk out into the lake and start surfing, you know, or the ocean or whatever, you know, the ocean where there is waves, you'll get pummeled. You know, you have to know your way around it, and you have to know where those are breaking and when they're breaking. You have to watch the weather. And that helps a lot if you're going to be doing it, you know, a lot. But like I say, it could, you know, you live in Colorado, it's dumps, you know, 6-8 inches or something, and that's like perfect. You could ride on grass without even a base, you know. But you do have to be smart about it. You know, you don't just walk up the side of the mountain and there's 6 inches of new snow on rocks or something and you just get worked. Same thing with, you know, surfing. You paddle out, you just get pummeled or you get ripped out to sea in a tide or something. And so it does help to have some knowledge, but if you don't have that knowledge, stick to the golf courses, stick to the grassy foothills, stick to your backyard that has a little hill in it, you know. Just simplicity is kind of the beauty of it. You don't have to take it super far like we do up in, you know, clear up into the backcountry and find the steepest slope that's holding snow on it or whatever, you know. You can take it as far as you want.
Well, so. It seems like it's like a, for me anyway, when I started powder surfing, it opened up like a new door of progression and actually took pretty basic terrain and made it like challenging in a new way. And yeah, I watch what you guys are doing today and you guys are way out of my league as far as like, I just enjoy riding powder on mellow slopes with it. But like, it seems like you guys have continually progressed from the time I saw that first video till today. You guys are doing bigger and more challenging stuff. Is there like a limit to the progression that you can have with power surfing?
I don't think there's really a limit. You just whatever you dare do or whatever you have the confidence to do. Like, you'd probably be surprised in yourself, you know, if we pushed you to a steeper slope that you didn't think you could do, you could probably do it. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. It's just, like, there's not really a limit. The sky's the limit. You can go steeper, you can do bigger airs, you can start if you incorporate skate style and start spinning and flipping the board, like, there's endless possibilities, like, for progression in all different directions.
So what's the
limit? And really, we were doing a lot of the bigger stuff back in the day too. We just weren't putting out that footage. Mm-hmm. And we kind of wanted to hold on to it and see what directions people were liking the most. And even today, sometimes I'll put out like a gnarly clip and I'm just like, oh, I don't know if this is a good idea. It just makes people like scared almost. Mm-hmm. And then we'll put out like a mellow, like, you know, 35 degree slope party run with three dudes going down. And then people really love that because it's more relatable and they're like, oh yeah, I could do that or whatever. You know, it's kind of like, you know, the marketing images that you see of skiing for ski resorts. It's like, it's not somebody doing a cliff. You're getting gnarly, you know. It's like some pretty girl like smiling huge, looking at the camera, and it's blue sky, and it's, you know, it's just more relatable and what looks ideal and perfect to people's eyes that are, you know, I mean, their demographics can be different than pow surfing, but still, like, sometimes the gnar isn't as inviting as some of the mellow and just fun stuff.
So what is the state of the art right now as far as like progression? What is the gnarliest stuff in terms of like the stuff that you hold like, okay, here's the next thing I have to do? Or where is that limit right now today, like after doing it for like almost 20 years, where is that like sharp edge today?
I think it's just a blend. It's just like backcountry snowboarding, you know, like it could be a gnarly chute or a gnarly cliff or, you know, a chute with a little mandatory in the middle, or it could be just a bigger air or a frontside 360 or a back three, or blending the tech with the mountain or just the shape of the mountain. It doesn't have to be like a giant kicker. It could just be like, you could do a backside 180 kickflip on this just rad looking natural hip, and that would be insane, you know. Mm-hmm. A small feature but a technical trick, you know. Or it could just be like, you know, seeing this long endless wave, right-handed wave, and just smacking the top of it over and over and over and over again until you're at the bottom and just exhausted and laughing your guts out, you know.
Right, but it's not about like scaring yourself. It's more about how much fun you can pull out of that board and that experience.
Fun and feel, and you know, everyone's progression is different. Everyone's on a different level, so it'll mean something different to every single person, no matter what level they're on. And that's kind of the beauty of it. And you know, you don't have to like snowboarding. If you snowboard a lot, it's, you know, you got to go bigger, you got to go faster, you know, I got to spin an extra rotation or whatever. So far to where you're like almost risking your, you know, your body, your life, or your body, you know, you're like, oh, I gotta do an 80-foot air, you know, or else I'm not going to feel like I progress as well as I did last year or whatever. And so it becomes more like, what can your body handle? And, you know, these calculated risks become huge, and they become, you know, pretty threatening to your body and your life in some situations. Whereas the power surf, you can keep it on a smaller level and focus more on like refined skill and, you know, blending with the environment or the slope ahead of you. It's a different feel, and you just get more satisfaction out of different things. And it's kind of seems to me like more of the fine tuned skill can come into play instead of, as much as just the huck factor.
Yeah.
Being
but
involved.
It seems like it's a lot easier to tomahawk on a pow surfer, as far as like, you don't have an edge to grab and stop you like pretty quickly. So
yeah.
if you're going pretty fast, you end up tumbling, and sometimes the board will hit you, and that's no fun. Especially
Absolutely.
Your first-generation boards.
yeah, the bigger, heavy things, you know. And you know, it's harder to stop from falling. Like with a snowboard, you're strapped in. You can use your tail, use your edge to stop yourself from tomahawking. When you're not, it's like, yeah, you could get hit a couple of times and still be tomahawking if you're riding, you know, a 40-degree slope or slower, something steeper and bigger. And so, you know, that in and of itself, it's easier to fall off. It's easier to, you know, crash or whatever. So it makes those smaller things more difficult and in turn more satisfying, you know. That's that's why you're having so much fun on the stuff that, you know, this mellow terrain that you never really would play around on before, but you know, now it's actually challenging because you're not attached to your feet, and you actually do have to move with the curvature of the mountain and the contours of the mountain, rather than, you know, fighting the fall line to get over here to this jump or, you know, whatever. You kind of have to go with the flow. And so the lines become different. And, I mean, you don't have to go with the flow, but it feels pretty lame if you don't.
Yeah.
You know, you can do more of letting the mountain be your guide. And that's kind of the more, you know, snow surfy feel, if you will, like the snow surf movement in snowboarding, you know, that's kind of come out of Japan over the past, I guess it's been going for decades pretty much. But
yeah.
But it's become hot right now in snowboarding, you know, the snow surf style, which is, you know, you're still strapped in, but you're using the terrain more, and it's not as aggro and death defying, but more based on style and flowing with like the curves of nature,
yeah,
if you will.
So let's roll back the tape a little bit here. So you started doing this in around 2000, early 2000s. 2007, you really put your first boards out, but you were releasing edits. When the first other brand or other people making these things, were you flattered, or were you like, were you kind of mad? Like, hey, this is my thing, and you guys should just use one of mine. We've been working on this for a while, because there are other brands out there that do make these things now, you know?
Yeah.
And when did that happen? When did you see your first other snow surf, that powder surf, that wasn't made by you?
Well, Volley's Asmo boards, you know, I was seeing those, you know, in 08, right after we were making ours. And it was clear to me, I was like, you know, they didn't just start doing this. They've been, you know, I've always been playing with this. I've always played on, you know, bigger Bidex snow skates, powder skates is kind of what they call them, or mountain skates or whatever. I thought it was cool. I was like, rad, like this, you know, it's coming from different corners of the earth. And, you know, his boards were completely different than what I was doing. And then there's like the movement in Japan with a friend of mine, Atsushi. He's making a brand that was, you know, all wood, really intricate, just beautiful work. I thought it was super cool because they were so different, you know. They were just like copies of what I was doing. I mean, that eventually did happen. You know, people would make things, you know, blatantly, pretty blatant copies of what I was doing. But I was seeing these other ones, you know, back then it was like, it was in Japan and it was in Austria with Asmo. I think Gatsushi's brand is Make. Mm-hmm. I believe is how he says it. And what was cool about his is it was so similar to what I was doing. It was like, you know, our name was like Grassroots. It was like the birth, the beginning of something, you know, and a seed, like planting a seed. And that was like kind of Atsushi's same theory behind his, you know, or just the same feel behind his, which I thought was really cool. Yeah. So I thought it was pretty cool. And then, but, you know, eventually when you see, you know, things that are pretty blatant ripoffs, you're like, fuck, man, like I've been working my ass off doing this, and then, you know, this comes along, and, you know, now my sales in, you know, Switzerland have tanked big time or whatever, you know, because originally I was selling stuff more internationally than here in the States by a long shot. And then, you know, as people out there would, you know, make a similar product, or, you know, some of it was like pretty blatant. And so, yeah, that bothered me a bit. I was like, fuck, like I've worked my ass off for this, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm creating all this media. I'm, you know, planted this seed and made it known around the world. And then, you know, then these people are taking a slice of your pie or whatever. And, but, you know, it's like, it's similar to what Dimitri did. Like I thought about, you know, putting a patent on it back in the day, but I didn't have extra $10,000 anyways. But, you know, it's like Dimitri had a patent on snowboards. He could have taxed everybody who made a freaking snowboard if he wanted to, but like that's not really going to help the sport come to grow more.
Right.
And it was cool. Some of these other companies or guys, or, you know, maybe it's just a crew of guys making some out of their garage or whatever. And I thought that was cool. You know, if you can't afford to buy one, you make one. If you want a really good one, you might want to buy one, but like, it's fun to screw around. I had a fun time screwing around, figuring out how everything worked.
Yeah, it's
but, you know, then I'd get people like making a blatant copy, or like trying to sell like pads to put on your snowboard, and then using my videos and my imagery to market it, literally. And I was like, what the fuck? Like double, you know, just taking advantage of all of the hard work I poured into this. And, you know, it became frustrating with some of those people, because I was like, damn, I worked a full-time job plus all this stuff for Grassroots. It equates to working hundreds and hundreds, you know, 100 hours plus per week for years just to get it off the ground. And then as soon as it gets off the ground, there's those people that, you know, see like something coming that maybe they can make a bunch of money off of. And, you know, that's the sad thing about business, and it always has been for me. Mm-hmm. So that was a bummer in some respects, but in others, like some people were making a really cool product that was different, and you could tell they'd been on their own road and figured this out on their own. And that's awesome, I think.
Yeah, I think
so,
like,
it was mixed feelings, you know?
Yeah, like similar to the early days of snowboarding, it's like a winter stick was totally different than a Sims board, was totally different even than a Burton or a Barfoot or a Prop or a Glacier,
yeah,
or an A-Team. They all had like, they all came down different roads and then kind of,
yeah,
at a certain point converged, and then kind of like there was like in the early 90s maybe, you know, the science more or less got settled as far as like, okay, it's got camber, it's got side cut, it's got a centered more or less stance, you know, and then the creativity and design kind of slowed down, right? And it seems like almost still at this point, there's a lot of different new ideas still coming into powder surfing. Do you see that?
Yeah, for sure.
And in snowboarding too, and some of them don't stick around very long or whatever, or some just seem a little too hokey or whatever, or maybe they just don't get adopted by the bigger brands. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of those are specific to the environment in which they were created, just like, you know, Winterstick came out of Utah where, you know, they have nice fresh powder, and, you know, Burton came out of Vermont where they have to ride a lot of ice too. So, yeah. You know, they come out with these different things on the boards that would not really be so great in a different environment. I think that's super cool and having it all blend together. But then as soon as, you know, we were allowed at ski resorts, then that really kind of dumbed things down a lot. You kind of had to have a flat base. And you had to have like a pretty solid binding system and all that. So yeah, that definitely, ski resorts definitely changed the trajectory of snowboarding back then. Yeah. And then, you know, pow surfing. Yeah. Lots of new and interesting things can come out. You know, some guys like to try to put a fin on it or whatever. And, you know, a lot of the things that we played with back in the day are just so many ways to put contour into a board, or even just rails, you know, almost, you had the premier snow skates that had those grooves down them, you know, that would make mm-hmm. them just go pure straight. And so if you angle these grooves and put them on a certain spot in the profile of your board, you know, they'll help hang on to a turn a little bit better or whatever. And yeah, it's cool. And it works, you know, it definitely works different environments. Like some days with really light and dry powder, your fin would be okay. And then other days it would suck. It would drag you down. It'd be slow. It'd make your board just go straight or whatever. And so, I don't know, it's interesting, and it's cool that they can come out of little microcosms, and it's mostly, you know, due to terrain more than anything, and terrain and style of snow.
Is there any kind of,
not created equal.
Are there any things that are kind of like decided as far as like everyone pretty much agrees that, okay, you're turning off the tail, and so the board is designed a certain way? Is there any kind of similarities that kind of evolved independently that you see like across these brands, where it's like certain things work and certain things maybe are just like a product of their environment? Are there certain things like design wise that actually work and are kind of agreed upon?
I don't know. There's a lot of different stuff. I mean, it's pretty easy to make, you know, something work almost anywhere. If you make like a giant nose, heavily tapered board, you know, it could even have, you know, and almost to the point where side cut doesn't matter at that point, you know, mm-hmm. whether it's reverse side cut or standard side cut, or because the thing is so tapered, it's just forcing the tail down into the ground, and that's like your rudder or whatever. It may not be as fast as the ride, but you could make it work if you stand on it, you know? So, yeah. I mean, that's a pretty universal thing, but still there's lots of exceptions to that rule, you know, like some of the reverse side cut, more surf shape boards that I make, can you ride it amazingly well, you know, you just have to know how to ride it. They ride different than a traditional side cut board or a board with a super heavy taper in it. But like I say, we offer 18 different boards, you know, and, some of those boards may not work as well in a super wet environment, you know, wet, settled snow. You might have a little bit of difficult time until you figure out where to stand on it, where to put your weight, and how to turn it, because it is a different thing. So I don't know if there's really a standard. I mean, you need grip.
So yeah, okay, there you go. There's one.
That is standard.
Yeah.
You want a slippery base so the board goes fast. Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. They could be made out of, you know, you could make them out of a snowboard style construction, and you know, you may want the flex to be different than a snowboard, but yeah, you can, there's just lots of little ingredients, and you put those ingredients together, you can make all sorts of things work. Mm-hmm. And, so I don't know. I don't know if there's a right or a wrong thing, you know, or a size that doesn't work. Like it can be pretty hard to ride a really long board, you know, something over like a 160 something. But if you take that board to, you know, pick a different wave, pick a mellow, you know, 25, 30 degree slope, the board will hold a lot of speed. You can still turn it. You could walk up and down it and surf it like a longboard, standing in multiple different positions because the slope you're riding is so small. Mm-hmm. So really, like, the diversity in environment and the diversity in snow allows for like a lot of variables to work. They may not be ideal, but they can work, and they could be interesting and fun, you know, like, yeah.
It's like surfboards. Like there's today, like a million people... different surfboard designs, right? It's like you could have a fish, you could have a longboard, you could have a fun shape, egg, whatever. I mean, there's all sorts of shapes, you know.
And they're pretty, you know, and they're designed to perform well in certain environments. And that's, you know, that's why I have, that's why we offer so many damn shapes and styles. It can be confusing to people and overwhelming when they see it at first. But, you know, I'll drill it down and be like, well, where do you live? You know, where, how big is your foot? Where, you know, what style do you like to ride in? How, what's the consistency of the snow and such? And so, you know, one of those 18 is going to fit them just right for their area, you know?
Mm-hmm. So they're all designed with a different wave in mind, basically, essentially.
Yeah. Different terrain and different snow consistency. Cause those are the two biggest variables in, you know, the terrain we ride or anybody rides. So, yeah.
Okay, so now you've been at this business for like 11 years. You've been making these things. You still have a full-time job, if I understand correctly. So let's talk about kind of the lessons that you've learned, like business-wise, life-wise, from creating this thing and having to learn every aspect of business. You know, what are some of the mistakes that you've made? What are the biggest mistakes you've made in terms of business and doing this?
Oh, shit, I don't know.
We all make mistakes, Jeremy.
I make tons of them. I have so many shitty shapes that don't work at all, kicking around my house still that are 11, 12 years old now.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, there's tons of those mistakes. Obviously, trying to make a board, like you have a theory in your mind and you want it to work out and it totally doesn't, or, like, you know, a certain contour in a base that just fought you like crazy and became useless. Like I have a whole grip of those boards, you know, that just straight didn't work. So production wise, tons of mistakes. As far as running a business, I suck at business, and maybe that's my biggest mistake. I don't know. If I was like one of those business minded people, then I probably would have maybe off the bat, like got investors and like, you know, came out huge and just suffered for 10 years while the rest of the world caught up and figured out what this was and figured out how fun it was or whatever, you know, but instead I had to work within my own means. You know, I work out of a tiny little shop. I can produce, you know, 10 boards this first year, whatever, 50 the next. And then, you know, on and on, I had to grow it organically, but I don't feel that was a mistake really. I think if I would have gone huge in the beginning, I probably just would have lost a bunch of money and investors would be all pissed and whatever, and I wouldn't want to deal with that over my head anyways. You know, I'm stoked that I was able to grow it organically and have stronger roots that way, if you know what I mean, and more soul.
Yeah,
but
you're keeping it real, definitely following your passion, you know, that's for sure.
I'm trying, but at the same time it's draining me, you know, like I'm working a full-time job while doing all this. Maybe that's a mistake. Maybe, you know, maybe I shouldn't have got married and maybe I shouldn't have had two kids, you know, then I could live in the gutter and, you know, I could live in a shack somewhere and just make these boards. And maybe that could actually be my full-time job and I could travel around more and I could share it with more people around the world and, you know, spend my life on the road. Whereas, you know, I'm married, I've got two little kids and so that takes a lot of my time and it spreads me pretty thin sometimes, but you know, Grassroots is still a size to where I can, you know, interact individually with every customer and, you know, give them super good customer service and, you know, treat them more like a friend than a customer or whatever. So I don't know, maybe if I could have started doing it 10 years earlier before I was married and had kids, and that would have been a lot easier on me. And then maybe I could just live poor and survive off of this one thing I created instead of, you know, just killing myself, you know, not getting any sleep and working 100-hour weeks for 10 years. And, you know, that's the thing that really wears on me. And then, you know, that's also the thing that kind of makes me upset when I see somebody making a copy. I'm just like, fuck, I worked so hard to get here. And now that this is like accepted as a thing, now there's all these vampires, you know, trying to make sucks and blood, you know, make money off of this wave or whatever, or what they think
right.
might happen.
Like the true investment isn't in just like buying the board. It's like the 10 years of history and development that came with that. It's like, it didn't just come out the way it is today. It's like you had to make all these little baby steps of progression to get to where you are now. And now people can kind of
right.
pass
and,
like a
lot
of those
all
steps.
The mistakes.
Yeah.
I made all the mistakes already, and so people can start, you know, right now and be like, okay, this is a basic shape that works, or I'll just trace this one out or whatever, like, you know, shoot at that because it looks like it's working or whatever. So yeah, that made it real tough because, you know, going to school full time while working full time while running grassroots and having a baby, like, that was one of the years that about fucking killed me. And that was just like 4 years ago.
It's like you're a circus performer with like 18 balls in the air juggling. You know?
Yeah.
How do you balance that? How do you keep your wife happy? How do you keep your business happy? How do you keep your grades happy to graduate school? How did you balance all that stuff?
That it was brutal. Very, very little sleep really is what it boiled down to. And super pissed off wife that I had to keep telling, you know, just one more year, honey, you know, maybe it'll break even, just, you know, one more year, like, it's on the cusp, I know it, just trust me on this or whatever. And it was tough. And then, you know, fortunately, it's just a winter thing. And so, you know, 6-7 months out of the year, I'm doing this, and then it slows down pretty significantly in the summer. And so I can at least, you know, my wife's so hyped when April and May comes around, because she's like, oh, we get you back. So I can now take them on, you know, camping trips and, you know, stuff like that every weekend.
You only work like 60 hours a week now during the summer.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. But for them, you know, they've been so deprived. It's like, oh my God, daddy's back.
Yeah. But I think that
speaks
to your passion.
They see how happy it makes me. So they're good with it.
Yeah. It speaks to your passion that you're doing something that you actually derive like a deeper sense of satisfaction from than a paycheck, you know, and maybe that's one of the motivating factors of why you're so driven to create this like segment of a sport, or the sport itself, I guess. Right. And be one of the pioneers.
I just love snowboarding, and I always have, you know, snowboarding, skateboarding are kind of what built me as a person. And so it's like a way I can give back to those things and, you know, share that passion with others. And then, you know, my wife, it finally allows me to be able to be like, look, honey, I need to go ride. I need to go get this footage, or I need to go take this trip here or whatever. And so a lot of the payment is that, like, I'm, you know, old enough to where I can't go snowboarding every day, but via, you know, through this company and this work I'm doing, I have an excuse almost to tell my wife I need to go ride. And so that's my paycheck, as I get to shred, you know, more than I would normally. You know, most people my age end up, you know, one day a week if they're lucky, or, you know, a couple of days a month snowboarding, and I would go insane if that were me, you know. So this keeps me riding, you know, 3 days a week during the winter, and I get to take trips, and I get to share it with people, and I get to see people super stoked, you know, the looks on people's faces when they ride them for the first time, or just any given day. You know, that's a payment, you know. It's not payment in money, but like, that kind of stuff is more valuable than money in a lot of ways, and all the life experiences. So I'm getting something out of it for sure. It's just not paying bills.
Right.
You know, that's why I work another job. So.
Okay. So last question, where is Grassroots? Describe yourself, describe your brand in 10 years. Like, where's Grassroots?
I don't know. I can see this little niche like continuing to grow. And so we'll probably just be making more boards. I think I'll still be, you know, making them here in Utah. And cause I really want to keep that. Like, I don't want to outsource. I don't want them made out of shitty materials or made out of plastic or made in China or whatever. You know, I want it to be like more special, you know, more of a piece of art than a commodity.
Mm-hmm.
So it'll probably be it will be just like it is now, but maybe a little bit taller of a tree, same roots. Probably just more product and getting more people stoked on it. And hopefully, like, I mean, my goal has always been to like quit my other full-time job, and, you know, that would be real nice to just be able to focus on this, and then, you know, it could grow as much as it could with the demand. And I think I'd be a happier person because I'd be able to focus all of my mental capacity and physical capacity on the company itself, instead of getting drained by, you know, working other jobs and things like that. So that's my hope, is that it can one day become at least profitable enough to where it could be my job and I could survive and support my family.
Cool.
So that's what I'm hoping for in the next 10 years.
And where are people going to go? If people now have heard your interview, they want to check out your grassroots board. Do they just go online? Are there shops at carry them? Where can they find a grassroots?
Yeah, there's shops all over the world that carry them. Powsurf.com. We've got a web store there. That's where most of them go through. That's probably the easiest, just because you can pick exactly what board you'd like, or you can, you know, contact me directly from there and I can help advise you on what shape is best for you. They're in shops all over Canada, Europe, Japan, States. So there's not a ton. There's probably a total of maybe 50 shops around the world carrying them. And that may get bigger. It just depends on, you know, demand, and kind of depends on it's, I think it's still something that people are beginning to understand and grasp and realize how easy it is to get out there and do it. You know, it's like, they just need more of a surfer's mentality, I think. And as that changes and as resort prices continue to skyrocket,
yeah,
and force more people into the backcountry, then that always helps too. But either way, like, it's just a refreshing thing to get away and to do it and remove that bind and see how much, you know, balance and skills you've developed with your years of snowboarding or whatever. It's going to keep going. It'll be good.
Cool. Well, thank you so much, Jeremy. I have learned a ton today. I had a lot of questions, and you had some great answers for me. So thanks for sharing.
Yeah, no problem. I live and breathe it, so it's pretty easy to answer.
Cool.
Well, yeah, thanks a bunch for having me. I appreciate it. I'm stoked.
Yeah, no, I think that was really cool.
So, yeah, powsurf.com, I guess your question was, where can they go? Powsurf.com, you know, Powsurf on Instagram is the handle, Powsurf on Twitter. I don't do much tweeting, but yeah, Powsurf is pretty much the handle for everything. So people can remember that, right?
Cool. Well, hopefully you don't have to work that full-time job too much longer, because I can see your passion. It's very clear, and it's so much fun, by the way. I love Powsurfing, you know, especially in the right conditions, for me anyway. But it's just an amazing way to progress as you get older. You know, you can progress on anything, really, on easier terrain, on you don't need to have, just like for me in snowboarding, it's like I have to have like the right conditions. And with pow surfing, I can do it in a wider variety of conditions, actually, when you're like a dedicated backcountry person. So it's
a lot of fun. You just change your terrain selection a little bit. And we've always called it the fountain of youth.
Yeah.
So for older guys, it's awesome, because it makes you feel young again, makes you feel like you're progressing again and learning. I mean, because you are, you know, learning more about snow, learning more about terrain, learning more about balance and what is possible. And so, yeah, we've always, and then for young kids too, like I've got tons of young kids turned on to this, like from really little. We do kids boards too, of course, you know, anywhere from 2-3 years old. And then from, what's really cool is the 12 through 14, 15 year old kids, like I get like letters in the mail, like a real letter. Remember those?
Yeah.
Like kids that are so stoked and just writing me a letter on how fun they're having and how this has got them into the backcountry and they've discovered all these new things. And, you know, these are kids who snowboard and skateboard and stuff, but it's really cool to get that kind of stuff back from people.
Yeah, that is cool. Like,
first
they have to learn what a post office is and what mail is before they can even write that letter. So that's pretty impressive. They go to a pretty long length to figure out how to write you a letter. That's really cool.
I think they've got good parents.
Yeah.
Or something.
Right on.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, thanks, Jeremy. I will talk to you here soon. And
all right. Cool.
Yeah, that was a good interview. I enjoyed doing that. So.
Nice.
This will be post-interview. Well, you know what? I mean, I just see the passion in people, and that's what I'm trying to share with this whole deal, is like the passion of like what keeps me involved and keeps me going like this whole time. It's like 32 years later, I still define myself as a snowboarder. It's just lately I've been asking myself why a lot more, you know?
Yeah, so. I think there's a lot of different reasons why for different people. And I mean, it all boils down to just a love of snowboarding in the outdoors, probably, but there's a lot of different things for different people that keep them going. I think it's super interesting, but I don't know if it's just because I'm getting older and I give a shit more, but Or I just can relate to those people more. But yeah, most people slowly fall away from snowboarding and have to turn into adults and parents. And it's, yeah, the few that keep going, it's, they usually have a pretty cool story as to why. So I think you're going down a good path.
On behalf of Mark Sullivan, thanks for listening to The Snowboard Project. Remember, ride fast, take chances, dream big, and take action. And for God's sake, don't be a...
Forget about it. This is the Snowboard Project, Season 2, End of Story.